This is Cincinnati Edition on a Friday afternoon. I'm Mark Purcell. Recently on the new Cosmos series with Neil deGrasse Tyson, he talked about extinctions. Over the last half a billion years on Earth, there have been five mass extinctions when the diversity of life on Earth suddenly and dramatically contracted. Scientists around the world are currently monitoring the sixth extinction, predicted to be the most devastating extinction event since the asteroid impact that wiped out the dinosaurs. This time around, the cataclysm is us. Writer Elizabeth Colbert explores what's happening in her book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. She spoke with Thane Maynard recently about the book and the sixth extinction.
Hi, Betsy. It's Thane Maynard from Cincinnati,
hey,
too.
Hey, Thane. How are you?
Very well. Good to talk to you again. And I'll say it was with great surprise when I realized after you had come to Cincinnati Zoo and, of course, written the big article on zoos for National Geographic, to then discover that our story and our rhino would even make it in your new book.
Yes, I know. I didn't know that at the time. How's that? So I can't say I knew that. Otherwise, I would have told you.
Sure. Well, congratulations on your book, because I can't turn on public radio or open up a journal that doesn't mention the sixth extinction. So clearly you've hit a nerve.
I'm very, very shocked to say it seems so, yeah.
And yet I'll say this, it's a daunting tale. It is. We're in a challenging time and you don't hold any punches.
No, I really didn't hold back, as you know. So I am really, you know, gratified that people are willing to devote the time to read it.
So here's the challenge, and of course it's an underlying part of the way you tell the story, but we do face, if not unprecedented, certainly here in the sixth extinction, unprecedented in the last tens of millions of years, challenges in terms of changing the way that the ecosystems and systems that support life on Earth are changing. Are there some stories where you can say, okay, well, in this given area or this coral reef or this habitat, some people are trying to kind of reduce the damage?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the places that I visited was the Amazon rainforest. And at one point I went out with people who are working for a small group called the Amazon Sustainable Foundation. And they were giving people who had been involved in, you know, illegal logging in the forest, they were giving them subsidies, small subsidies, you know, by American standards, not much money, to not make caring for the forest more financially rewarding than cutting it down. And when I was there, I talked to people. Now, I can't say I talked to them directly. I had to speak through a translator. But people who had really changed, you know, this changed the whole way they looked at the forest through this program. And it was really moving and interesting also to see, you know, how people's mindset could be changed very dramatically by relatively little, you know, little shift. And it made me really think, because, of course, these are people, you know, really living at the edge. They were not at all, you know, wealthy people. They were really just existing in the forest. And those of us in the U.S. who have so much, you know, what would it take, you know, for us to just sort of shift our perspective? So I do think there are tons and tons of people out there, you know, doing great work.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you hit on really quite a note there when you talk about that question of, on one hand, out on the edge of wild areas or in the depth of them, you've got people that are living sometimes in poverty. So there needs to be a win-win for them, so it makes some sense. But then there's also that global economy. When I think of, say, for instance, poaching, I mean, to me, poaching seems totally ridiculous because that's not something that's part of our mindset. But you can also understand how it would happen, given that the resource is near poor people and there's a market somewhere else.
I don't claim to have the answers to these problems. I mean, for example, the bushmeat trade is a huge, huge problem in Africa for very, very endangered animals. And, you know, we can sit here, where in the States, and, you know, you can go to the supermarket and buy a burger. But if this is what you're feeding your family, and it's, you know, your kids versus this endangered animal, we are not in that situation. So it's you know, very difficult for us to judge. Now, that being said, since we are in a position where we could try to mitigate this problem with the resources of the U.S. and the developed world in general, you know, I would have to say we're not really putting the resources into it.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. I've been involved in the zoo business and the conservation business a long time, and like anyone, as the years pass, you do reflect and say, gosh, what's really been effective? And of course, in trying to protect wild areas and wild species, you're never done, right? So it's always, well, we did a great job, now we have to wake up and do it again tomorrow. That whole question of sustainability, particularly in third world nations, is challenging.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I think that that is one of the real themes of the book, really, to be honest, is that, you know, when a lineage comes to an end, that's it. There's no turning back. You don't get that species again, and you're never going to. That's just not the way evolution works, you know. And so these are things that we're doing really unconsciously that have permanent impacts. And as you say, you know, it's not like a battle that is won once. It's a mm-hmm. battle that gets fought and fought and fought and fought until, unfortunately, in many cases, it ends. And that's the end. And that's the tragedy of it.
You know, your book's also a great history lesson, talking about human perspective on this, you know, going way back to Europe and then on up through Darwin and, of course, to today. But the thing I find fascinating about that is, on the one hand, globally, particularly in developed countries, we're more aware than ever. We care more than ever. We spend more on conservation than ever, but the problem's getting worse.
Well, that is exactly the paradox of our time. And, you know, that is why the book, as you say, is not, it's not full of easy answers. I mean, the paradox of our time is that we do care. And the Cincinnati Zoo is a really, really good example. And Suchi and the efforts mm-hmm. of people like Terry Roth, mm-hmm. You know, to mate Suchi and produce another rhino for this incredibly endangered species and just a fantastic, fantastic animal that everyone would be very, very sad to see no longer on the face of this earth. Meanwhile, you know, the threats to that species and so many others are, as you say, just increasing. They're always ramping up. I mean, we're not even sure exactly why the Sumatran rhino is in so much trouble. You know, is it deforestation? Is it poaching? Is it invasive species? Is it some combination of all these? On top of that, you know, we're layering now climate change. So the challenges are enormous and growing, even as you say, as attention to these issues is growing. And that's the situation that we find ourselves in. It's, you know, not a happy one.
It isn't. And as you've known that for a long time, listeners might not know, you're a staff writer for The New Yorker. And, of course, your first book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, chronicled the challenges of climate change. And yet somehow politically there's still all this hand-wringing and debating when all you have to do is look outside in the town you live in and come to realize we're at a time of a pretty serious climate change and we need to make a correction.
Well, you know, I'm speaking to you actually from Washington, D.C., which is sort of the seat of, you know, on some level, this weird, and I use the term in quotes, debate over climate change. It's not something that we should be having a debate. In that book, I also talk about sort of the history of science. You know, we've known since the 1850s that carbon dioxide was a greenhouse gas. That discovery was made in 1859 by a scientist named John Tyndall in Britain. There's now something called the Tyndall Center for, you know, Climate Studies. And he was a wonderful scientist, sort of a polymath in that sort of great, you know, Victorian way. And there's no surprise here. Everyone has known that. That's just an established fact. And if you're adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, as we are, you know, then you would expect, sort of your basic expectation would be that the Earth would warm up. And once again, that's just pretty basic science. And you can have all sorts of very sophisticated models to try to find out exactly, you know, what the impacts are. But on the first order approximation, you put CO2 up there, you're going to get a warmer world. And the more we've learned about the history of the planet, the more we realize what an extraordinary thing it is that we're doing by taking all this CO2, really massive, massive amounts, out of the ground and putting it into the air. And when you think about it, you know, it's not something that can happen very easily without people. It's just a very, very unusual thing we're doing. And unfortunately, it's going to have very, very unusual consequences.
You know, in your book, one of the things I found moving is you had a good discussion about the oceans and ocean acidification, causes of that, and also how drastic that is.
Yes, ocean acidification is sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin, and some scientists would go so far to call it global warming's more evil twin, because as extraordinary as changing the climate is, changing the chemistry of the oceans is actually really, really hard. There are a lot of forces at work trying to keep, I shouldn't say trying, they're not conscious, but that work to keep ocean chemistry stable. So people who have looked, tried to tease out what the chemistry of the oceans has been over literally hundreds of millions of years have come to the conclusion, these are several different studies using different lines of evidence, have come to the conclusion that, you know, if we just keep putting CO2 into the air, and a lot of that CO2 is ending up in the oceans and changing the chemistry of the oceans, because when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid. That's, once again, just a basic fact of chemistry. So if we continue on, then by the end of this century, probably we will have changed the chemistry of the oceans more radically than they have changed in the last 300 million years. Okay, mm-hmm. So that is pretty significant.
Yeah, that's important to all things on Earth, not just the ones who happen to live in the ocean as well. Well, Betsy, thank you for spending a few minutes with us. As I said, I think your book really is terrific, and I'm glad it's had the great response it has.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
You bet. Take care. Let me know if you're coming back to Cincinnati Zoo.
Okay, will do.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye.
My guest has been Elizabeth Colbert, author of the new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Thane Maynard.